Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
To make good decisions about protecting our environment, we must first have good data about the state of it. And increasingly, that data is coming from high places, which is to say laboratories installed in special airplanes to measure everything from the amount of carbon stored in forests to the snowpack in the Sierra Nevada. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Greg Asner is an ecologist with the Carnegie Institution for Science, and he is the creator of the Carnegie Airborne Observatory, which has been used all over the world to monitor the health of ecosystems, plants, and animal populations, and may give scientists the power to not only document climate crises, but one day to predict and even prevent them. He's featured in Pulse of the Planet, an article by Peter Miller in the November issue of National Geographic, which focuses on climate, and we are delighted he could be with us to talk about his work today. Greg Asner, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
What can you monitor from the air that you can't tell from the ground, or at least can't tell as completely from the ground?
Well, we've developed a sensor package that's installed in the back of our aircraft, and that sensor package can measure a variety of properties of the environment. It starts with the terrain. We're able to measure the details of the rolling hills and the underlying geology of the terrain that really supports our ecosystems. Other parts of the instrumentation then measure the actual biology that sits on the terrain. Some of those sensors measure the tree canopy, if it's a forest, for example, in exquisitely detailed 3D. I'm talking about the height of the vegetation, the branching architecture, even the foliage on the trees. And then other instruments on board fuse themselves with that 3D look and are able to measure, believe it or not, the amount of certain types of chemicals in the vegetation. I'm talking about water, nitrogen, sugars, other nutrients, things that really tell us a lot about how the ecosystem is doing physiologically, which is basically similar to going to the doctor and getting a blood test. You go in, you have a look at your blood makeup. The doctor gives you an update on how you're doing, potentially. We kind of do the same thing by looking at the chemistry of the vegetation.
Do you or a colleague have to be on the plane, or can you just send a pilot up and switch everything on before he or she takes to the air?
It's a laboratory. The state of the science today is that we want scientists up in the airborne observatory working with the data, with the pilots, to collect the data and assess what they're seeing in real time so that decisions can be made to, say, change direction of the aircraft to go to another area of interest or importance. So the airborne observatory, the look and feel of it on board is two pilots up in the cockpit, 2 to 4 scientists in the back, working at desks, computers, quite a large computer capability on board, and then all of that technology is communicating to the back part of the aircraft that contains the sensors.
So this is a large aircraft?
Not so big. It's a Dornier 228. I guess with if you were putting passengers on board, it would hold about 20 people. We've taken all of that kind of commuter seating and all of that kind of stuff out and put in a very high-tech laboratory that supports the instrumentation, the computing, and the people space working together as a single lab.
I would imagine that passionate scientists like you can come up with a lot of amazing ideas for what if this existed and we could use these instruments. How do you take what starts with a good idea and convince funders and institutions to get behind it and actually build the thing?
Well, I have a lot of experience with that process, and it's one where you have to be at the forefront of your field. That's a lot of us are, and I have a lot of colleagues that I share that position with and enjoy the science, but you have to go beyond that. You have to be communicating with potential stakeholders. That might be, in my case, environmental management community, conservation community, state and federal. Whoever it is that might utilize our information, we want to be engaged with them to help them understand where the science is going and how it can actually underpin and support their processes, whatever they may be. At the same time, you have to be engaged deeply with potential sources of support. Sometimes that's federal. A lot of times nowadays it's private. And I've been very fortunate to have funding and support from certain private foundations and individuals who are really forward-thinking. They're seeing what we're doing as a future capability. They want to try to bring it to scale and to bring it, you know, from total R&D out into the operational world. Think of it that way.
How fast does the plane go making passes over whatever it is that you want to assess? How low do you fly? Talk about that.
Well, it depends on the scientific question. When we're doing a large area, we mapped the Amazon basin in Peru. That's a really large area, about three times the size of California. In that case, we flew mostly about 7,000 to 8,000 feet above the ground. And we're flying at about 150 knots. And the limits to that are technological. Of course, the plane can go higher and faster, but it's really about the instrumentation being able to collect up the data fast enough. This is a big data kind of environment where if we're flying too fast, we're actually getting too much information per minute. So we pull back the throttle and try to get a careful look at these places, collecting the data in a very steady and systematic way.
One of the disturbing but important things you discovered in the Amazon basin was that there were these hidden mining operations, which are illegal and which are detrimental to the environment, but which were really hard to spot earlier.
Yeah, that's an example. In our work, I think of it as discovery, conservation, and action, and sometimes those three come together in a moment. And the gold mining situation was exactly that. We were out mapping, actually doing mostly biodiversity work, using our instruments to understand how the forest canopy is changing in its composition. Well, we already knew there was gold mining going on in the region. Reports were that it was getting to be quite a problem. During the mapping, we came across so much gold mining that it put a big question mark in our minds on board the plane, thinking, this is a lot more than we've heard about. So we basically turned the aircraft around and started mapping very specific to the gold mines and trying to get a very good grip on what we were seeing in terms of area and how much damage the gold mining was causing and so forth. It turns out that we took that information and we went straight to the Ministry of Environment of Peru, and that's the ministry that is really dealing with those kinds of issues, and they engaged us very deeply from that point forward to try to use the information to deal with the problem. They knew they had the problem, but we just basically doubled its the level of the problem by seeing so much more gold mining than anyone had known.
Was this the evidence that helped to convince the Norwegians, of all people, to pay some Peruvian interests to quit clearing for any kind of development?
The Norwegian investment in Peru's forests and this program that attempts to reduce deforestation and forest degradation, that the Norwegians are unique that way. They provide funding to governments that are attempting to reduce those trends of increasing loss. Our work supports that. What we've done is create maps of, in this case, the Peruvian forest and how much carbon it stores, and at the same time train the Peruvian Ministry of Environment technicians to carry that work forward, to utilize those maps and to utilize the science, to be able to report back to organizations like the one that's supporting them from Norway, to show that they are able to engage these problems of gold mining and other sources of deforestation and reduce those problems over time. So what the science does in this case, what our airborne mapping is capable of supporting, is monitoring for performance, meaning here's the condition today. Norway is investing in Peru. They can continue to utilize our techniques and us, literally, to continue that monitoring and to report back whether they're being successful in utilizing those investments from Norway to reduce those losses.
Let's talk about deforestation. This is something that has been on the minds of the general public, which is to say not scientists, since at least the 80s. But for a long time, the idea was simply, you know, trees are nice, forests are important, we should hang on to them just because. As it turns out, growing plants, and particularly those in forests, are really important sources for absorbing the additional carbon that human activity continues to generate.
Yeah, that's right. Forests, well, let's say in the last decade, the scientific community that I'm part of has begun to understand more deeply that forests serve a two-prong role at least. One is they do sequester this carbon that otherwise ends up in the atmosphere, which contributes to climate change. And the amount of carbon that's sitting in the forests of the biosphere in particular is massive. To give you an idea, the amount of carbon that's emitted from tropical forests through deforestation every year is equal to, more or less, the total amount of carbon that's emitted from the entire transportation sector globally.
Wow.
So it's a huge amount that doesn't need to go into the atmosphere if we can keep it in these forests. Then the other prong is, well, these forests that are standing, that aren't being deforested, are acting as sponges. They're able to soak up more carbon over time. And so that gives an incredibly useful, powerful, invaluable buffer to the rest of our emissions that we're, you know, undergoing as a society. So these forests are really critical in that capacity.
Another thing you've been looking at is the speed at which plants and trees are growing. Can you talk about how you can tell that from the instruments on the plane and why that's useful to you?
So trees turn out to be difficult to understand in terms of their growth. Understanding how large they are and their actual biomass was a challenge, but I think we've licked that one, and we can fly over and really assess the mass of a tree. Now, to predict how well it'll do, say, in the next week or the next month or the next year, that's altogether more complicated, and that's where the chemical mapping is critical. What we measure in tree canopies that tells us about their physiology, how well they're doing taking up carbon dioxide, is really wrapped up in a few measurements. One is how much water is in the canopy, because water underlies all the physiology of the tree, just like it does for you and me. Secondly, how much nitrogen is in the canopy? Nitrogen, it turns out, farmers have known this for many forever, that how much nitrogen is in plants has a lot to do with how well they grow. So we want to understand that from the air as well. A third one is sugars, and that's an odd one to talk about, but it turns out to be very important. Kind of like if you're running a marathon and you pull over at a support station, and if you were to have your blood sugar tested, yours might be doing pretty well, and I probably wouldn't be doing so well if we were running a race or something. And the sugar content of our blood would tell us, you know, how well we're getting, how well we're processing the carbon that we're taking up, and in our case, the oxygen that we're using. And in that context, sugar tells us a lot about whether the tree is growing well or not, because they take up carbon dioxide, and the first thing they do in the process biochemically is convert it to sugar. So these metrics of chemistry, these chemical metrics, I should say, all together tell us a lot about how well every single tree we fly over is doing. Whether it's dead, that's easy to find, but more challenging is whether a tree is growing more slowly or more quickly. And that's what we're after with this technology that we have on board called imaging spectroscopy. That's the chemical detection.
Greg Asner is my guest. He's an ecologist with the Carnegie Institution for Science, featured in Pulse of the Planet, an article by Peter Miller in the November issue of National Geographic focused on climate, the entire issue. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we have phone lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Support for KERA comes from you, our members, and from Texas Mutual Insurance Company on behalf of the Insurance Industry Charitable Foundation, supporting local organizations that offer assistance to veterans and at-risk youth. More information at IICF.org. Amphibian Stage Productions presenting Freud's Last Session. On the day England enters World War II, Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis debate love, sex, life, and God. Performances October 29th through November 22nd. Details at amphibianstage.org. LookoutTexans.org is reminding you to treat cyclists on the road the same as motor vehicles. Your bicycling friends and neighbors use roadways for transportation to work, school, and other destinations. By providing a minimum 3-foot safe passing distance, motorists and cyclists can maneuver safely and avoid sideswiping collisions or accidents. Look out, think ahead. More at LookoutTexans.org.
What if, instead of browsing the World Wide Web, we were all browsing GopherNet?
Gopher is easy to navigate and easy to browse.
Because in the early 90s...
Gopher was taking off faster.
Until they made one crucial mistake.
At that point, Gopher traffic on the internet dropped off.
Find out why open source won the battle for the internet next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday afternoon at 2 on KERA 90.1.
This is 90.1 KERA. Today on The World, a new film about an old tradition in Ethiopia, men abducting teenage girls to make them their wives. In this story, the girl fights back and kills her abductor. The real-life story that inspired the film on The World this afternoon at 2 on KERA 90.1.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with ecologist Greg Asner of the Carnegie Institution for Science. He's featured in an article called Pulse of the Planet in the November issue of National Geographic. That entire issue is focused on climate issues. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Greg, the idea that you can measure things like sugar levels and nitrogen and other what you call chemical metrics from the air without taking a single sample, without landing that plane and pulling anything up, makes me think about the possibilities of technology like this for exploration of very distant planets that might have life on them.
Interesting. Yes. Well, the technology that's really core to this chemical sensing capability has the name imaging spectroscopy. And that's done by an imaging spectrometer. And it's interesting to think that we actually have imaging spectrometers orbiting Jupiter, Mars, the moon. We've had them, at least in our solar system, looking for chemical signatures, not only biological, but geochemical as well. We haven't had the same class of satellite technology in Earth orbit, at least not in the civilian world. And that's why we've taken it to the air, both to advance the science and exercise our understanding of how to use the technology, but actually to apply it in novel ways so that we can get other scientists excited about it and then stakeholders excited about it. And that, we hope, will, you know, drive us towards new satellite missions that might, in this case, put an imaging spectrometer into Earth orbit.
It would be hard to decide what you wanted to focus on if you had something in Earth orbit and you could essentially look anywhere on the planet.
Yeah, well, I know I would be very interested in understanding the biodiversity of the planet. Our estimates of the composition of our ecosystems is pretty rough when you think about it. It's based on fieldwork mostly, and most of that fieldwork has been in places that are more accessible, especially northern forests and northern ecosystems. If you go around the tropics, a lot of those ecosystems have not been fully inventoried and probably could not be understood just by fieldwork alone. So, you know, that's my personal interest in using an imaging spectrometer in Earth orbit. The great thing about the technology is it has so much information built into its capability, what it can put out, that it can serve a lot of different communities, the snow and ice community, ocean community, atmosphere, and so forth. So this type of technology offers a lot of scientific and both in terms of discovery, basic discovery, but also applications across all the different types of land surfaces and even the ocean on Earth.
1-800-933-5372 is our phone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jason in Denton. Hello, Jason.
Hi, I'm a student of computer engineering.
Jason, are you with us? I think somehow
aircraft.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, repeat yourself, please. We missed you just a moment ago.
Yeah, I'm a student at UNC doing computer engineering, and I was curious about the computing power that you carry in the aircraft. I was wondering about how you power the computer, since a multi-engine aircraft isn't going to put out that much power. I was also curious as to how the cooling works, and I was wondering if you could speak to the resolution of the imaging packages you carry so we can get a better idea of how altitude relates to surface area to pixel ratios.
I love that question because it's one I would never have thought of, Jason. What can you tell us, Greg?
I love the question because it sounds like I have somebody I should be talking to for a future position, maybe at Carnegie. Great questions. Power. Well, the computing is designed specifically for data capture. And one of the interesting things is that when you run these imaging spectrometers, nowadays they have so many spectral bands. Think of it that way. For non-experts, you know, your camera might have three spectral bands, you know, red, green, blue. Our systems are collecting in 480 spectral bands. So it's a lot of data. And in a flight, we can easily collect 2 terabytes of data. So the computing is designed on board to do that hard job of rapidly and correctly collecting up those data and putting them on solid state drives to store them for analysis later. The other thing the computers do on board is provide us with real-time understanding of what we're seeing on the ground. And that includes the spectral and chemical information, at least kind of the, call it the raw data, the basic information as we fly over. So that's a computing capability that is one that's very hard to get right, to be able to collect the raw data and literally within seconds or hardly with any delay, see it emerge on the screen. In terms of power, we do have thanks to my engineers, we have 2 solid engines on board our plane. They put out a total of about 120 amps of power, which is enough to keep us going. And then in terms of the cooling, probably the most interesting fact is that our imaging spectrometer has a detector in it, inside, that requires, it needs to be at minus 132 degrees Celsius. That's ultra cold. And to do that, we use 2 devices called cryocoolers. And those devices are powered with the rest of the sensor package and the aircraft power to keep that detector very cold, because without it being cold, we're actually not able to register the spectral information that comes into the aircraft. Short answers to really long answers, but that gives you an idea.
How long has the Carnegie Airborne Observatory been in service?
Well, I guess its birth would be November 2006. That's when I built and we deployed CAO-1. That was an initial effort supported by the Keck Foundation to get us literally up in the air with a basic imaging spectrometer and a basic laser scanner. We used a very small aircraft back then, a Piper Navajo. I barely fit a pilot and a person in the back. And we used that to build up our understanding and our capability, mostly in California and Hawaii, where we've done a lot of testing. And then by about 2011, we launched CAO-2, which was a big step up. And between 2006 and 2011, we had not only operated CAO-1, but we had been working deeply with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena to advance our capabilities in building instrumentation that would feed more challenging scientific questions. So during that 2006 to 2011, it wasn't just like we were building new instruments. We were actually doing science that was driving the need for new instruments, and that iteration with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory turned out to be ultra powerful for all of us. 2011, we launched CAO-2, like I said, a much more capable set of instruments. and then use that to map very large regions like Peru, Colombia, Panama, large parts of California, and so forth. And again, built up more understanding and advanced our capability scientifically and on the engineering side. And then in this, just this past May 2015, we launched CAO-3, which is the new aircraft platform with basically tuned up and more capable sensors in the back of the plane.
I would imagine that year over year data is really instructive. If you take the imaging spectrometer or one of your other pieces of equipment and you go over the same land area and compare it to, you know, some time before, what do you do about the first time, and how do you compare those data with the ones collected through more traditional means on the ground, and how useful is it? Is it like an apples to oranges kind of comparison?
There tends to be the apple to oranges issue there. What I find is in the first mapping of a region, we spend about a third of our time using the data to convince ourselves that what we see on the ground matches the data. And that's a process. It used to be called ground truthing. I prefer the term ground matching. So the best, you know, what can you do on the ground to understand the status of a forest, its biomass, its chemistry, its physiology, its biodiversity, and how does that relate to the aircraft data? That's part of what we do the first time out in a certain region or a given region. The other thing we do that's more exciting is, in the end, is that the maps that we generate in the first visit to a region tend to reveal patterns in the environment that are unknown to science. To me, that's the most exciting aspect of visiting a new region with our airborne observatory. And what I'm talking about is patterns in the vegetation, stuff that you don't see with the naked eye or with traditional measurements on the ground or even with satellite technology that's in space today. I'm talking about patterns in the composition of the forest, patterns in the three-dimensional structure of the vegetation, patterns in the chemical makeup. And that pattern that emerges in it, you know, with a first visit tends to propel hundreds of scientific studies. And occasionally it propels action and concern if we fly over something that you know, wasn't really well known, like the gold mining. So that's the first visit. Then you mentioned repeat visits. That's when it gets extremely powerful. And that's quite hard to do with aircraft. When we go back to Peru, it's quite a lot of work to get back down to Peru and do the work, and logistically and so forth, programmatically. But once we get down there and do it, in that case, the change that we're able to see is extremely useful to us scientifically and in terms of conservation and environmental management. So it has a very nonlinear effect from that point forward. This issue of repeat is why I'm so adamant on trying to get an imaging spectrometer into Earth orbit, because it'll obviously allow us to look at any place on Earth, probably the repeat of about once per month or better. So that's the kind of thing you can do from space that's harder to do from the air.
And of course, if you had something in orbit, you don't have to deal with local and regional governments, some of which are probably much more amenable to the idea of an American plane flying over their wilderness than others.
That's true. I'm extremely fortunate for many reasons to work at the Carnegie Institution for Science. And one of those reasons is we're pretty well respected around the planet as being the right kind of science, scientific effort, think of it that way. And we put science first. We're not there to get into the mix of internal politics necessarily unless we're invited to help out. That tends to allow us to get to places for the most part. That said, you're right. It's a lot of work to get not just flying the plane to a foreign country, but I mean actually getting the proper documentation and paperwork and permissions and so forth. It tends to consume a lot of our time. So it is something that going to orbit would solve a lot of that. Going to orbit, the only real drawback is we would take a hit in terms of spatial resolution. But that said, I think that the hit is relatively minor compared to the gain. And being able to observe Earth every month with one of these instruments would, I think, be transformative for the science and for the management and conservation and policy communities.
You gave a TED Talk about, among other things, airborne monitoring of lion behavior from the air, and you made a really unexpected discovery about male and female lion behaviors.
Yeah, it's funny. Obviously, when I maybe not so obviously, but when I entered this field around 15 years ago or more now, I came into it from a vegetation plant ecology kind of angle. And over the years, we realized that the kinds of 3D imaging we're doing is defining the habitat for other types of living organisms like lions and other animals that utilize these habitats. And so we entered into a project in the Kruger National Park in South Africa. Our partners are the South African National Park Service. And one of the questions we had was how does the different structures of the vegetation out in the African savanna affect the behavior of, for example, lions? And it's an important question for park managers because they actually can change the 3D structure of the vegetation through fire management. Use more fire, the system opens up, a lot of the woody plants disappear and you get more of a grassland view. Suppress fire. We know this in the U.S., you get a lot of buildup of the woody vegetation, so forth. So they actually want to know, well, what are the habitats that lions prefer? We flew over and mapped the Kruger in 3D. And at the same time, our colleagues had GPS telemetry collars on these lions so that they could track exactly where the lions were going and where they were hunting. And they have a whole technique for doing that. What we found was that the female lions were doing their hunting, kind of a critical activity for lions, but also for tourists, out in the open part of the savanna, the grassy part that you can view. You drive into the park in your car and you can see this happening. The male lions, which had the stigma of never hunting, kind of sitting back, that lazy male lion look, having the females take down the prey and then the male shows up, sauntering over to the prey, shoos away the females and eats the animal that's been taken down. That is true, but we also found that the male lions are actually doing a lot of hunting, just as much hunting, but they do it in the dense woody vegetation, the spooky stuff that as an ecologist, I wouldn't want to be walking around out there by myself looking for male lions because you might get ambushed by one of these big guys. So we made that discovery and we reported it, and I think it changed some of the perspective, both in the scientific community and the management community, that we can't really see with our own eyes the ecology of an ecosystem very well, even when it comes to a charismatic species like lions that we think we know everything about. We're still using technology to make fundamentally new discoveries about their behavior.
And for all this time, the reason it was unknown to science was that anybody who witnessed that male lion hunting behavior was probably on the menu.
Probably on the menu or probably nuts. I've spent a lot of time out on the ground in these places, and it can get pretty spooky. I mean, you can be with three other people and you still feel like you're on the menu.
Can you actually see out the windows in the observatory? I know that's not really why you're there.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time looking out and making decisions as to where we might go next. We don't need to use the windows to decide where to go. We have some very nice navigation that we put together. We can sit in the back and basically stare at computer screens and make decisions from back there using incoming satellite data on terrain and vegetation cover and climate and weather and so forth. But a lot of times I just want to look out the window and see with my own eyes either, you know, what it is we're sensing back on the displays, or to convince myself that what I'm seeing on the displays might be real out there. And that's an interesting process back and forth to the window.
Ecologist Greg Asner is with us from the Carnegie Institution for Science. He's among the scientists featured in an article called Pulse of the Planet in the November issue of National Geographic, which focuses entirely on climate issues. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think or email think at kera.org.
Support for KERA comes from you, our members, and from Sovin European Sleep Systems, mattress systems built of natural components and designed for durability, adjustability, and comfort. Sovin European Sleep Systems, rest healthy, live well, SOVN.com. Texas Oncology, with a reminder that a yearly mammogram can lead to early detection of breast cancer. Mammograms are recommended for all women aged 40 and older. More about breast cancer at TexasOncology.com.
Charles Koch has done pretty well for himself in this economy. He doesn't think, though, that it's working all that well for everybody else.
Doesn't that bother you that the median income and the income of the least advantage is going down?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Charles Koch, yes, that Charles Koch, on what else he wants to fix next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6:30 on KERA 90.1.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, talking this hour with ecologist Greg Asner of the Carnegie Institution for Science. You can read about his work in an article in the November issue of National Geographic. It's called Pulse of the Planet. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Carrie in Arlington. Hello, Carrie.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Great show. I was curious if this technology can be used by someone like myself. I'm an urban forester, and we assess, you know, tree health on a, you know, individual tree by tree level. I was wondering if there's some way to apply this technology to what we do. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Great question. It's the kind of question I want to be asked because it helps me to define and refine what our science can do to support people on the ground, just like you heard. The measurements we make from the air today with the kinds of instruments we're talking about are very similar in certain ways to what ecologists and foresters and so forth want to make out in the field. For example, how tall is a tree? How is the canopy doing? Which is actually quite hard to figure out in the field. Try climbing these things. It takes a long time and is a slow process. But those kinds of measurements tend to be very useful to people, and that's why we've designed the instruments and the science behind it to use the instruments in a way that would interface. In terms of getting access to it, that's really what I want for everyone. So I'm in a group that's trying to advance these technologies in the academic side, trying to make them kind of leapfrog-style technologies that'll go from R&D, where we started, to operational capabilities, and then promote that to get, you know, NASA and other organizations to put some of these instruments into space so that everybody can have access to that information.
How can the data you collect be used to predict future crises, things like droughts and flood conditions that meteorologists couldn't do?
Well, there's, that's a huge area of research that's moving quickly. In terms of using our style of instrumentation, what we're mostly after is the response and the feedbacks to climate change. So the response meaning the biological response. How is the vegetation changing? And then what does that mean for, say, future responses? An example is the California drought here where I'm working. We have this extreme drought that we're in, year five or so. We're mapping the forests, not just where the forests are and their basic structure, but their water content. And it's a good example of how this can work with climate science. We're starting to understand through our repeat flights that there are these breakpoints where there's enough drought and enough heat to kill off large numbers of trees. We can fly over and look for dead trees, but what we'd rather be doing is flying over and looking at their chemistry and seeing whether areas, certain parts of the forest are vulnerable or not, and predicting whether they are going to die. Very hard to do. We're right in the middle of the science of working that out. But the goal is to be able to make predictions based on climate shifts and changes and whatever we're undergoing, so that then the folks who do modeling can utilize those our observations as feedbacks in their models to then make long-term forecasts, both of a long-term forecast of the state of the forest, say, but also the feedbacks back to, say, local climate. So there's that going on. And then there's this whole other world that I don't work in very much, but it's featured in the National Geographic as well, which is the satellites that actually directly measure aspects of our climate system, carbon dioxide levels, rainfall, temperature, and whatnot. I think that that community has a really important and is exercising its important role in supporting the forecasting community, so that nowadays the forecasts are becoming very geographically detailed because of the kinds of satellite measurements that can be done today regarding a bunch of different climate factors.
At this point in our development of these technologies, there aren't any ameliorations that you can make, right? You might be able to predict the conditions that would cause a section of forest to die off, but you can't do anything to fix that, or people that you'd work with can't do anything to fix it.
I don't totally agree with that. That would be me putting the most negative cast on say a tough day that I might have up in the air when I see a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
But in general, when I average over everywhere we go and what we are able to map, what emerges is literally a map that can actually play a role in management of the Earth system. And that sounds like a crazy concept, managing the Earth system, but that's what we're doing at this point. There's so many of us, there's so much activity on the land surface that we're able to do things that have real impact. One of those is fire management. In California here, the fire management that goes on now, both state and federal level, is mostly responding in a reactive mode to fires that break out. What we'd like to do is make maps of canopy or forest canopy vulnerability in terms of their water content in each tree in the forest, and then use that to provide tactical information to managers to, for example, put in fire breaks or use prescribed fire to get dead woody material out of the ecosystems, therefore reducing future conflagrations. So those are the kinds of tactical management approaches that can be made possible if you have the right kind of maps. And currently those maps they don't exist. So we're trying to develop that capability in parallel with the basic science and the discovery that we also undertake.
We have an email here from Brett in Louisville who writes, I'm interested if their study included the permafrost in the Arctic and all the methane it contains. I was surprised at the tonnage of methane within the permafrost and the potential damage to our environment if it should melt.
Yeah, it's a very important question. Methane and carbon dioxide coming out of permafrost, you know, up in the far north, boreal systems in Canada, Alaska, Russia, the forest is underlain by these huge amounts, huge stocks of carbon that sit in peat or in permafrost. And with warming up there, which is actually proportionally much higher rate of warming than, say, this far south in California, those warming levels are causing what scientists believe to be large losses of carbon through CO2 and methane. This is one of the reasons why we need a spectrometer in space, because I can't get my plane up there on a regular basis. I'm focused in the regions where I can have, you know, impact today. So that's why we need an imaging spectrometer in space. That system would be able to monitor changes. And incidentally, imaging spectrometers are very good at detecting methane.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thank you very much. I wanted to ask you specifically, as a scientist, you use particular machines to do your studies and particular math, and I just wanted to know where does that arise from? Do you do the math and create the machines, or how does that come about? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
That's great to get that question from the gentleman, and I often get that from students as well, and that's very motivating for me. My background is in physics as an undergraduate and as a biologist as a PhD student. So I combine these traditionally separated fields of physics and biology and chemistry into one field. And the science that we've developed, and we have developed a large fraction of the science that I'm discussing, but I also have a community of scientists that I work closely with that also have contributed heavily throughout the years. So, and we all have kind of similar backgrounds in one way or the other. We're the scientists, and then we marry our effort with the engineers. And the engineers out there are those who are extremely capable of building these instruments, whether they're laser-based or spectral optical systems. And for me, that's been a very deep relationship, for example, with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where my colleagues, I believe, are the best in the world at building imaging spectrometers. So it's that tight fusion and camaraderie between science and engineering that produces these kinds of outcomes.
Do you naturally speak the same language, or is there a period during which you have to sort of figure out how to communicate what it is you want so that you can put the engineers to work solving the problem of fabricating this instrumentation?
It's a relationship.
With all that entails, right?
These engineers spend a lot of time with me, but we're best of friends over these years because we all have the vision from two different angles that this can make a real difference. So, yes, you learn each other's jargon, acronyms, and they're changing because our fields are evolving in parallel, right? So you have to stay connected. It's not a once-a-year thing. It seems to be every week or more often.
The interesting thing about science, one of many, is that, you know, down through the centuries, data that have been collected haven't always been apparent immediately for the value that they might contain. So, like, how do you decide how much you want to collect and what to hang on to, even if there doesn't appear to be an immediate practical application for some set of conditions that you have monitored?
Yeah, I get the question, and it's a tough one to answer. What I've done since I started the Carnegie Airborne Observatory, luckily we haven't thrown any data out. Mm. We keep it stored. And it's amazing that data from 2007 still yields new discoveries. People come to me all the time, students, postdocs, colleagues, many, you know, from all different parts of the scientific community with an idea. And we'll pull the data and lo and behold, there's a discovery made. So I've learned not to throw anything away, and my staff spends a fair bit of time keeping the data available to us and to our colleagues. In terms of when we're operating and flying around, that's tough because you just don't know. And this is the limit of airborne science, is that it takes the person, the scientist, to be up there for a reason already, and then to have kind of a more general view of what might be useful going into the future. So as an ecologist, I'm mostly focused on the biology, but if I pass over a glacier, I'm going to collect it because you never know. Again, this is why we need an Earth-observing imaging spectrometer so that people like me don't have to make those tough decisions that sometimes don't work out.
How does the cost of an orbiting version of the Carnegie Airborne Observatory compare with the fantastic plane that you have now?
Satellites are expensive, but it's an economy of scale effect. So mm-hmm. if we can put a satellite up for $300 or $400 million and spread that cost out over all the taxpayers, say, that's probably and will yield years and years of data for everyone everywhere on Earth, then that's very cost effective in that scale context. For me, it's tough to keep an airborne program running as a single investigator with a relatively small group, and the costs are pretty high. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars over the years, so it takes a lot of work to keep the program going. They're just different. It's an apple and an orange in that case.
I think it was on your website that I saw two photographs of the Sierra Nevada. You've measured the snowpack there?
No, that's a colleague. Okay. I've been working the vegetation below the snowpack. My colleague at JPL, Tom Painter, has been working for years now on the changes in snowpack. But he's been obviously witnessing and reporting the extreme losses of snowpack, especially over the last 5 years.
Well, give us an extent of how what the effect is on the vegetation. I think people can, at least even if they haven't seen these photographs, they can picture in their minds a picture that shows, you know, a normal year and what it's been looking like lately, and there's just a fraction of the amount of white stuff in those pictures. What happens to the things nearby that normally would count on that runoff or that frozen water to allow it to grow?
Yeah, California snowpack is just crucial. We go through a very deep, normal, dry season here. Call it, June through October, November every year. That's normal. So we rely on water that comes in via snow in the Sierras. Comes in normally, November through May. And so that storage of water in the form of snow and ice has radically decreased in the last five and or more years. The vegetation below absolutely relies on that runoff from the snowpack, but so do all of us down even further down below in below the forested watersheds in California. So one way or the other, the snowpack is a feeder for all of us.
Greg Asner is an ecologist with the Carnegie Institution for Science. He's featured in the article Pulse of the Planet in the November issue of National Geographic by Peter Miller. The whole issue focuses on climate. Greg, it's been a really fascinating hour, and I so appreciate you making time for us.
It's been fun talking to you. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Natalie Kalman-Kuhn. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.